This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In reality, there is absolutely no plan of what is going to happen, because in theory only, the Syrians that are at the island can apply directly from the island for relocation and reunification.
That's Mariana Karakoulaki reporting from the Greek island of Lesbos. D-Day details coming up. Also, the president of Botswana says Zimbabwe's 92-year-old President Mugabe should step down immediately. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the International Human Rights Organization Human Rights Watch, HRW, calls for the member countries of the International Criminal Court to address Kenya's failure to cooperate in its case against President Uhuru Kenyatta. HRW says its behavior is a breach of the country's obligations to the court or to ICC. The decision is the court's first finding of non-cooperation sent to ICC members and to the Assembly of States parties. Elizabeth Evenson is an associate director in the International Justice Program at HRW. She spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis about the legal obligations of member countries to take Kenya's obstruction of justice findings seriously and take strong action against it.
An ICC trial chamber on Monday ruled officially that the government of Kenya had failed in its obligation to provide the ICC prosecutor with cooperation in its investigations against the president of Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta. That case has been withdrawn, but this has been a long-running issue. And essentially, the prosecutor had asked the government for help in locating certain records of President Kenyatta, bank records, land records, information about vehicles he owned. They hoped that those records might contain some evidence that would go to the heart of the issue, which is whether or not President Kenyatta was implicated in election violence that took place in 2007-2008. And the judges on Monday, after quite a long-running set of rulings at the court, this had been before the trial chamber, it went to the appeals chamber, it came back to the trial chamber. They made clear once and for all that they found that what the government of Kenya had done in the case had fallen below what's required of a country like Kenya that belongs to the ICC.
What do member countries need to do with this point?
The way the International Criminal Court works, it's an independent body, but it doesn't have its own police force. It doesn't have a way on its own to enforce the judge's decisions. So what it does have, however, is the entire membership of the International Criminal Court, so 124 countries that belong to the ICC, including Kenya. And together, these countries are known as the Assembly of States Parties. And under the ICC treaty, if a member country like Kenya is found to be not cooperating, that finding of the judges is sent over to all 124 countries that belong to the ICC for enforcement, for follow-up, to make sure that the judge's decisions are respected, and in this case, to make sure that cooperation could be possible, if not in the current case, which has now been withdrawn, then in any future cases that the ICC might bring in Kenya, and also just in general, to set a clear precedent that ICC countries have obligations to the court, they need to cooperate, the court depends on that cooperation to get its job done. And our call is really to states parties that it's time to get serious about this. The court depends on cooperation. It can't be the case that a government can just refuse to provide cooperation and by doing so be a significant factor in what undermined the ability of the prosecutor to go forward in the case against President Kenyatta. Not the only factor, but a significant one.
What are the consequences of a non-cooperative country? What are some examples of consequences when countries do not cooperate?
Up until now, the most sort of high-profile instance of non-cooperation have really been around the case against President Omar al-Bashir of Sudan. The ICC has issued two arrest warrants for al-Bashir on charges related to crimes committed in Darfur, but so far he has not been arrested. And unfortunately, he has traveled to some ICC countries without facing arrest, and those countries are obligated to carry out the court's orders. But what happened here in the Kenya cases is also extremely significant because the ICC prosecutor also depends on countries for assistance in investigations. And here, by not doing what it needed to do, to look for records that the prosecution had requested or to explain better why it wasn't able to provide those records in a way that would have satisfied the judges. I think also this decision on cooperation has to be looked at in a broader context. So the decision of the government of Kenya not to fully cooperate in these investigations, that went hand in hand at the same time with a lot of hostile rhetoric against the court and trying to drum up opposition to the court within Kenya to make it more difficult for witnesses to come forward, and also in the African continent to try to lead a campaign against the ICC and to erroneously blame the ICC for getting involved in Kenya, when in fact the ICC got involved in Kenya because Kenya did not provide justice for victims at home. It's important to keep in mind, certainly we know that there are many, many, many countries within Africa that are ICC member countries that are supportive of the court. In fact, just recently at the last African Union summit in July, a couple of countries, in particular Senegal, Nigeria, they were willing to stand up and say, you know, we are not in favor of a drive to remove Africa from the ICC. That's incredibly important, and those voices need to get louder. Those countries should be supported for standing on the side of the ICC, standing on the side of justice.
Elizabeth Evanson is an associate director in the International Justice Program at HRW. She spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis from Brussels. When fire broke out in the Moria detention camp for thousands of migrants and refugees on the Greek island of Lesbos on Sunday night, hundreds of families fled into the dark. They had nowhere else to go. 3 days later, local officials are still struggling to relocate more than 2,000 who remain homeless. Reporter Mariana Karakulaki is on the island and talked to VOA's David Arnold about efforts to relocate.
Generally, the mayor of Mytilene is trying to push the government, as well as European governments, in order to distribute refugees from the island equally in the other municipalities. Because, as I told you, there is no capacity at the island at the moment. What the government will do, and actually they have agreed, they will send two different ferries in order to accommodate the refugees. These ferries are supposed to be arriving tomorrow afternoon. In reality, there is absolutely no plan of what is going to happen, because in theory only, the Syrians that are at the island can apply directly from the island for relocation and reunification. All the others have other options. For example, they can apply for asylum in Greece, or they can return to their home countries voluntarily, or they will be returned by the Greek authorities. At the moment, there is no official plan to take the refugees from the island into the mainland.
About how many do you think there are, and what nationalities are they?
I believe there are a couple of thousand. There are people from Eritrea, from Ghana, from Pakistan, and from Afghanistan. These are the people that I've spoken to. But Moria is a mixed camp, a mixed nationality camp.
Have you found out what caused the fire?
From what the majority of refugees told me yesterday, the Afghan refugees decided to stop the hunger strike. Around 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock, the fire started. Most of the refugees say that it was refugees from Afghanistan. And others claim that it was an accident by tear gas thrown by the police. Some people claim, especially the locals and local authorities, claim that right-wing extremists were started the fire outside the camp in Moria, the village, which was disrupted by Golden Dawn members. The Golden Dawn is a Nazi party in Greece. Not very clear who actually started the fire, but then the fire spread all over the camp, and almost 60% of the camp has been burned.
How large a camp was this? How many migrants and refugees were there in it, and where have they all gone?
I'm not sure how many people are in Moria, because they're not separate numbers. In Lesbos, there are 5,700 people, and the capacity of the island is 3,500. So in Moria, there are maybe a couple of thousands of people. When the fire started, a lot of people started going towards the town of Mytilene, quite far away, in order to be able to sleep. So some people slept in the town of Mytilene. The unaccompanied minors were taken to a center called PIKPA. It's a voluntarily run center for vulnerable cases. And others presumably slept outside of the camp. Yesterday, during the time that I was at Moria, people still didn't know where they were going to sleep.
If you call it a detention camp, Is this a place where they were prohibited from leaving the camp?
The camp is nothing like I have ever seen. It's like an open-end prison. Barbed wire outside, a heavy police presence. Yesterday there was a lot of riot police as well. It is quite overcrowded. People live inside ISO boxes with maybe 13 or 15 people, which does not allow them to walk inside the box. And others live in the camp tents. This camp used to be a reception center in Lesbos. And after the EU-Turkey agreement, all the camps in the islands, including Moria and Karatepe, which is the second one in Lesbos, they were turned into detention centers. So for me, Moria looks like an open-air prison. People are detained. So when they arrive at the island, they stay inside the camp without the ability to leave it 25 days. After this time, they are allowed to go outside, but they are not allowed to leave the island. They cannot go to the mainland.
That was Mariana Karakulaki on Lesbos Island talking to VOA's David Arnold. 42 world leaders continue their week-long meeting of the 71st session of the United Nations General Assembly. This week, a prevailing topic of many leaders addressing the gathering has been the refugee and migrant crisis. The Associated Press notes that today, on the International Day of Peace, the UN Secretary General called for all warring parties to respect a 24-hour ceasefire. Several African nations are also expected to address the forum today, including Namibia and Ghana. This morning, Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe spoke before the Assembly. He lauded the body for enacting sustainable development goals, which aim to improve social and economic development by 2030. But he said his country was being held back by Western sanctions.
My country, Zimbabwe, is the innocent victim of their spiteful sanctions imposed by the United States and other Western powers, and these countries for some 16 years now have maintained the sanctions on us. As a country, we are being collectively punished for exercising the one primordial principle enshrined in the United Nations Charter, that of sovereign independence. As long as these economic and financial sanctions remain in place, Zimbabwe's capacity to fully and effectively implement Agenda 2030 will be deeply curtailed. I repeat my call to Britain, Europe, and the United States and their allies to remove the illegal and unjustified sanctions against my country and its people. Let us all be bound by our commitments to Agenda 2030, under which we agreed to eschew sanctions in favor of dialogue.
The U.S. and Europe imposed sanctions on Zimbabwe 16 years ago to protest ongoing human rights abuses, including the expropriation of a commercial white farms by the government without compensation to the owners. Many of the farms went to members of the ruling ZANU-PF party and its cronies. The sanctions are aimed at Zimbabwe's ruling party leader and include travel bans to the West and a freezing of their overseas assets. Western governments and institutions say the ruling party has mismanaged the economy, which had shown signs of improvement a few years ago, under a unity government with the opposition. Meanwhile, the president of neighboring Botswana told a Reuters reporter today that President Mugabe should step down immediately. Mr. Khama says more than 15 years of Zimbabwe's economic and political decline are dragging down all of southern Africa. Mr. Mugabe has been the elected leader of Zimbabwe since 1980. An Egyptian criminal court's decision to freeze the assets of some leading Egyptian human rights organizations last Saturday is raising U.S. and U.N. concerns. The U.S. State Department has urged Egypt to lift the freeze. Bahi El-Din Hassan is general director of the Cairo Institute for Human Rights, one of the groups targeted by the court. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi asked him about the basis for the Egyptian court ruling.
If you're asking about legal basis, there is no legal basis. It is purely a political consideration, but it is implemented by a court, by three judges. The claim of the judges, the judge who submitted the request on behalf of the Sisi government, is that there is ongoing investigation in a large case against tens of independent human rights NGOs in Egypt, and this requires to freeze the assets of some organizations in case that the ruling of the larger case would result in seeking financial compensation from those organizations and or individuals.
But the government is saying that the reason is what it terms illegal foreign financing of these organizations.
It is just a claim, but to prove that, investigation should take place, and even a hearing in the court for the lawyers and for the persons and the organization. But this didn't happen on the first place. Even me, myself, as a person, as individual, and also on my professional capacity as director of the Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies, I haven't received up till this moment a request from the court to appear before this court.
So what should the U.S. do to help NGOs operate freely when President Sisi says while he is in New York that they are already working freely?
First of all, the United States should adopt a consistent policy with Egypt. In fact, we received, as well as Sisi government receives, a mixed message. There is a message which comes from Mr. John Kerry, the Secretary of the State Department, which is blessing all the time all ongoing repressions in Egypt, not only against the human rights NGOs. So, in fact, such a statement, consequent statement, whatever made in Washington, D.C. or in Cairo or in New York, it is green lighting what is going on by Sisi government, whatever, against the human rights NGOs and defenders or against peaceful activists, press syndicates, journalists, lawyers, physicians, and so on.
But the United States Department of State called on the Egyptian government to lift these asset freezes and ease the restrictions on association and expression. Would that change the Egyptian government mind?
No. Sisi government received always mixed message. So if I am in the shoes of Mr. Sisi, I would say, well, let us wait and see how would be the next statement by the State Department.
That was Bahi El-Din Hassan, the General Director of the Cairo Institute for Human Rights. He was speaking to VOA reporter Mohammed El-Shinawi. The U.S. State Department's Conflict and Stabilization Operations Bureau tracks conflict around the globe. Reporter Adam Phillips spoke with Assistant Secretary of State David M. Robinson, who coordinates that effort worldwide.
The Bureau works to look at issues that principally affect violent extremism and atrocities. And we also pay attention to violence that may be destabilizing around transitional moments, elections and things like that.
Why is it in the United States' interest to do so?
We understand that partnerships are what make things work better, and when countries are able to work together on transnational issues, that's the benefit to the United States, and stability is important to us to make sure we have good partners and that we are a good partner ourselves.
So in a practical sense, what does your work involve? What do you actually do rather than just express an interest that people sort of get along together?
What we try to do is understand the dynamics of a conflict in a certain place, you know, and we try to understand the issues that are driving that, to understand the people that are driving that. And we try to give that information that we have discovered to ambassadors and to country teams so that they're able to resolve those issues or to, you know, try to bring people together in mediation so that these problems can be resolved.
So pretend we have this big map of Africa in front of us. In terms of your own perspective, what do you see? What's going on sort of in the big picture in terms of Africa? And maybe you can give me a few sort of islands of examples of places with which you have to do.
One is East Africa, the Horn of Africa, and we are concerned about violent extremism. And we're concerned about what's happening in Somalia and elsewhere. And we're trying to make sure that our policies are coordinated. The same thing in Nigeria as we look at Boko Haram and other areas. Nigeria obviously is a very influential country. It's a major partner. And so we're trying to work with Nigeria, but also its neighbors, Chad and Cameroon and other places, to make sure that we can address the issues that are driving Boko Haram. In case of Kenya, we are interested, as is the government of Kenya, in making sure that elections go well. And so our job is to support our ambassador and our embassy to better understand what's percolating.
Can you give me an example of the kinds of things that percolate?
You clearly have folks who will resort to violence, who will resort to threats. And what we're trying to do is to offer an opportunity that says don't do that. It's far better to have mediation. It's far better to come together and discuss these issues. In Ethiopia, clearly there are demonstrations that are occurring, and what we have seen is that the way that a government reacts to demonstrations and upheaval has an impact on whether those issues will be resolved. And so what we're trying to do is understand the dynamics underneath those things and pass those on to the ambassador.
I can imagine a certain potential for conflict of interest when you, on the one hand, want to get people in an equal playing field around the table to discuss their issues, and at the same time, United States policy is such that you may want it to go one way or the other.
The U.S., I think I can say this without difficulty, we support systems. We support processes. We want elections in certain places to be free, fair, open, and the outcome is what we're going to deal with later. In terms of transitional moments, what we would like to see is that those transitions occur peacefully. That's our interest, that my bureau's interest. And then we deal with what we get on the other end. But we certainly are not in the business of skewing things.
That was David M. Robinson, the Assistant Secretary and Coordinator for the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations from New York. He spoke to VOA's Adam Phillips. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, the 71st United Nations General Assembly is underway in New York, including a first-of-its-kind summit of heads of state and government to address large movements of refugees and migrants with the aim of bringing countries together behind a more humane and coordinated approach. We'll discuss that and other issues next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.